Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens when somebody under the age of 18 is brought in for police questioning? While the American justice system provides separate courts and different sentencing standards for juveniles and for adults, these youthful alleged offenders are often questioned by the same interrogation methods as those used on grown-up defendants. And those tactics produce not only evidence that can be used against them in court, but as my guest today will tell us, they can also elicit confessions that turn out to be false. Barry Seafeld is Centennial Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota. His new book is called Kids, Cops, and Confessions, Inside the Interrogation Room. Barry, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris.
You write about the fact that we have long held two competing images of juveniles as either immature and vulnerable or mature and capable of adult-like decisions and thinking. How do those disparate ideas tend to play out in the criminal justice system in the 21st century?
Well, the law, on the one hand, tries to be very protective of kids, which is exactly why we have juvenile courts. And on the other hand, it uses adult legal standards to gauge juveniles' exercise of rights or waivers of rights when there's a lot of reason to believe that juveniles are not adults and therefore can't exercise their rights as effectively as adults. And that treating them just like adults effectively puts them at a disadvantage in the justice system.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about some of the differences in how cases sort of go through the system. How would, say, a 14-year-old and a 20-year-old be treated for allegedly having committed the same crime?
Well, they would both be investigated and picked up by the police. And once the police pick them up, they would be brought to interrogation rooms, and they would be interrogated by police officers. Some jurisdictions have juvenile officers who question juveniles, as contrasted with, you know, regular detectives or investigators who would question adults. But when they actually have suspects inside the interrogation room, one of the things that's very interesting is they basically treat the kids the same way. They give them the same Miranda warning. Most jurisdictions do not use a dumbed-down Miranda warning to make it more accessible to kids. And juveniles then have the same option as adults to invoke their rights or to waive them. And courts look to see whether or not a juvenile's made a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver. And they use that same standard for a 14-year-old as for a 20-year-old.
You know, it seems, you know, when you say dumbed down, it would make sense in terms of comprehension that if you said, you don't have to talk to me if you don't want to, anything you tell me I can use against you. Why wouldn't the language be changed to be comprehensible to a young teenager?
Well, police are rightly reluctant to try to change the language because both state and the Supreme Court have upheld the use of certain magic words.
Right.
You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you. And so to the extent that these are court-approved warnings, police and prosecutors would be concerned that if a police officer tries to explain it in a way that differs from the warning that courts have approved, that they might get in trouble. So they are typically issued Miranda warning cards, either by the county prosecutors or by their police department or by the State Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And they just follow the cards to the letter because they know as long as they follow the letter of the law, they can't get into trouble.
Yeah, and this is something you write about, the fact that the Miranda warning has shifted in some ways and in certain jurisdictions from being inherently a protection for criminal defendants, criminal suspects, into something that is sort of a get-out-of-jail-free is wrong, but a protection ultimately for police departments.
Yeah, because the Supreme Court decided Miranda because it encountered enormous difficulties in trying to figure out whether a suspect's confession was voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
And voluntariness just raised lots and lots of judicial administration issues in terms of trying to assess somebody's subjective state of mind. So the Supreme Court adopted Miranda as a way of giving an objective indicator of whether or not a person was aware of their rights. And it has turned into a safe harbor for police. As long as police comply with the warning requirement, judges are not going to look behind to see to what extent did this person really understand the words, as long as, you know, they're familiar with English. And they're not going to closely look at what happens during the interrogation process after a suspect has waived their rights. So really, Miranda is the beginning and the end of protection of suspects in the interrogation room, and it only requires a very shallow understanding. You know, do you understand the language, literally?
And you make the point that criminal suspects, juvenile and adult, have to assert their Fifth Amendment rights at the very moment when they are the most vulnerable. They're in this police-dominated environment. They've been taken under arrest. They have not been formally charged yet with a crime.
Right. The Supreme Court, in a whole series of cases, has said that suspects who are given their rights must make a clear and unambiguous assertion of their rights. They have to invoke it clearly and precisely. They have to say, I don't want to talk with you, or I want a lawyer. And if they don't say it that explicitly, then most jurisdictions allow police to continue to question them. And most recently, the Supreme Court held that a suspect who sat in a room for 2.5 hours without responding to anything when he finally made an incriminating statement, the court said that was an implied waiver of his Miranda rights. So the court has shifted the burden from the state to prove a suspect has waived their rights to really putting the burden on the suspect to clearly assert their rights.
So what do we know about how well juvenile defendants as a group tend to understand what their Fifth Amendment rights are and their other rights under the Constitution?
Sure. There are several different ways of answering that question. One is to look at what the developmental psychologists have found as they look at juveniles' understanding of Miranda rights, at juveniles' competence to stand trial, and the broader issue of awareness of rights. And the developmental psychological research shows that particularly for youths who are 15 or younger, they tend to be pretty clueless, and increasingly so. That, you know, going back to your earlier question about a 14-year-old, the evidence there is that, you know, 14-year-olds really have a very, very limited understanding of even what the concept of a right is. So that's one way of looking. The second is when the psychologists have looked at juveniles' competence to exercise rights in other settings, when it comes to trial or when it comes to waivers of rights, again, it suggests that juveniles 15 and younger are by no means the equals of adults, even though the legal standard for the exercise of rights, again, is the same legal standard that we use for adults' waivers of rights. My research focuses on 16 and 17-year-old juveniles charged with a felony. And that research corroborates another part of the developmental psychological research that suggests that 16 and 17-year-olds begin to understand the words at about the same level as adults. You know, with the important qualification that lots of adults don't understand their Miranda rights either. But these 16 and 17-year-olds are about on a par with the adult levels of understanding. But again, Miranda requires only a very shallow understanding. It only requires that you understand that you have rights. It doesn't require you to understand the consequences if you waive your rights. It doesn't require that you understand even what you're being investigated for. It literally just requires that you understand the words that the police have given to you about the rights themselves.
So they may not understand, and there's no need for anyone to confirm that they get that the presence of a lawyer might be beneficial whether they speak or not.
No, I mean, there's no requirement in the Miranda framework or in state laws that they appreciate the benefits that a lawyer could provide them, because we've just told you have the right to a lawyer. That's all Miranda requires, and it doesn't require any understanding of the collateral consequences that will follow if somebody waives their rights, that you're not going to have any plea bargaining leverage, you're going to be processed much more quickly, you're not really going to have a trial because the real trial is occurring right now in the interrogation room when you incriminate yourself.
So what kind of information, and we'll talk about interrogation methods in a few minutes, but what kind of information do police typically gain when a suspect, we'll talk about juvenile suspects here, a juvenile suspect is interviewed?
Well, they're going to gain several kinds of information. Partly just getting a confession or an admission is an important piece of evidence in and of itself. And most juveniles actually confess, you know, which is also true of adults, you know, that they give a confession, which basically seals their fate. Even if they don't give a confession, they make what in the law we would call an admission, which is to say they provide some kind of incriminating evidence that can be used against them. You know, they'll say, well, I didn't actually go in the store to rob it. I just stood watch outside. And they don't understand that that makes them just as guilty.
Right.
So confessions and admissions are probably the most important thing that comes out of the interrogation process. But police will also use the interview to get leads to recover physical evidence, and they're often interested in recovering stolen property or getting guns. They can also use the information to find leads to other witnesses or the identity of other co-defendants. And anytime they get any information from a suspect, it also limits the suspect's ability to testify later at trial because those statements can be used to control anything that they might say if they testify in a different way.
What's the difference between a sort of routine investigation and the bare light bulb sort of high pressure situations that we might talk about in a few minutes?
Probably the most striking thing about this research I did, I looked at 307 felony interrogations, and you know, the thing that struck me was how relatively benign they were.
Mm-hmm.
The police were not coercive. They didn't threaten the kids. Most of the interrogations took place in interrogation rooms, but they're not really they're just sort of the bare room with you know, a table and a couple of chairs. But you know, there wasn't a lot of the bare light bulb imagery that we see on television.
Mm-hmm. So there can still be it can still be problematic for a young person who doesn't understand the process that's taking place.
It's more than problematic. I interviewed a dozen and a half police officers about their experience interrogating these kids, and you know, about a third of the officers used exactly the same expression to describe these kids. They called them deer in the headlights.
Hmm.
You know, they just described these as you know, especially for kids who were in there for their first felony arrest, as just really scared or cowed or intimidated just by virtue of being there and knowing how much trouble they were in.
Yeah. Barry C. Feld is my guest. He's Centennial Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota and author of the new book, Kids, Cops, and Confessions, Inside the Interrogation Room. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program and Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Barry C. Feld is my guest this hour. He is Centennial Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota and author of the new book, Kids, Cops, and Confessions, Inside the Interrogation Room. Join the conversation by emailing think at kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Barry, talk about this. Studying juvenile interrogation is a challenging thing for a variety of reasons, not least of which is that many police departments have been resistant to the presence of social scientists there to sort of document what's taking place. What, first of all, is their objection to having others there watching what's going on?
It's really remarkable that this book of mine is only the second empirical study of what happens in the interrogation room since the Supreme Court decided Miranda more than 40 years ago. And mostly it's because of lack of access. And there are, you know, several reasons why police might be reluctant. I mean, one is simply that part of the psychology of interrogation is to isolate a person and be able to interview them one-on-one. So if you start having observers in the interrogation room, that immediately is going to change the dynamic and perhaps give a suspect, even if the observer is just sitting there quietly, a little more psychological support.
Mm-hmm.
The second is police are concerned that some of the tactics they use may not look good. And to the extent that they're concerned that some of the tactics might not play well if other people know about them, that's another reason why they have everything to gain by secrecy, and nothing to lose by maintaining secrecy. So there's just the concern that somehow the presence of another person might affect the dynamic or reduce their ability to elicit information from someone.
So what kind of information were you able to study?
Well, Minnesota is one of the very few states in the country that requires police to record all interrogations. And Minnesota has required police to conduct all of the interrogations on the record since 1994. And so I was able to get 307 felony interrogations of juveniles from the county attorneys. They gave me unrestricted access to the files in two urban and two suburban counties, and my research assistants and I just went through every 16, 17-year-old felony file to find any in which juveniles had either invoked their Miranda rights or in which the police had questioned them. And every time we found an indication of a waiver or an invocation of Miranda rights, we just copied the whole file. So I have, you know, what is the richest database of routine felony interrogations of juveniles that exists in the U.S. And so that was what I based my research on. And then I interviewed all the criminal justice professionals to make sure that what I was finding in these tapes corresponded with their reality, and that was really how I posed the question to them, that nobody's done this before, so I want to make sure I get it right, and I was very reassured by the police and the prosecutors and the defense lawyers and judges that what I was describing was really the reality that they saw.
In Minnesota, are those tapes, those files, are they fully admissible in court?
The tape recordings are admissible in court. They provide a very strong piece of evidence for the prosecutor in most cases. As long as police follow the Miranda protocol, these tapes are an important part of the prosecutor's case. And, you know, and quite frankly, when police record these interrogations, they virtually eliminate the ability of defendants to go to trial.
Mm-hmm.
Because once they've confessed in the interrogation room, that really is the trial. And as a result, the very few cases go to trial because there's such powerful evidence against these youths.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think some people may be listening and saying, look, we most of us agree that if someone has committed a crime, they ought to be held accountable in some fashion. And many people would imagine that if someone confesses to a crime, the only way that would possibly happen is if they are indeed fully guilty of
it. Well, and there's another whole body of research that looks at false confessions. And one of the things we have learned, you know, as the Innocence Project has been moving people off of death row and out of prisons after 10 and 15 and 20 years of incarceration, that there are many people who are wrongfully convicted. The Innocence Project, at last count, over 300 people have been proven wrongfully convicted.
Many in Texas, as I know you're aware.
Yeah, it's very problematic. I mean, including people on death row. And it turns out that in these wrongful conviction cases, typically somewhere, depending on the research, you know, about 20 or 25% of these wrongful convictions involve people who gave false confessions. And false confessions differ from the kinds of interrogations I was examining in a couple of important ways. I mean, the first is simply that the police have made a mistake about the guilt of the person whom they are questioning. And once they make that mistake, particularly if they're questioning an innocent person who insists on their innocence, police actually question them more vigorously. You know, they use more coercive tactics because police are used to people lying to them. Mm-hmm. So if an innocent person says, "I didn't do it," the police assumption is that they're lying, and so they just have to interrogate them more vigorously in order to overcome their resistance. And so when we look at false confessions, they typically tend to be very lengthy affairs. About 85% of the false confessions occur in interrogations that last at least 6 hours. And more than two-thirds of them occur during interrogations that last 12 hours or more, so that they're really just wearing down a person's ability to resist. So that as I looked at my interrogations, you know, about 90% of them, the police concluded them in less than a half an hour, mm-hmm. whereas in the false confessions, they're very, very lengthy. The second thing that shows up in the false confession research is that police use a lot of very coercive tactics. They use, you know, what the psychologists call maximization tactics, which are designed to intimidate or scare. They will confront suspects with false evidence or made-up information.
Like your buddies all said you're guilty and we know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, like your buddies all said you're guilty, even if your buddies didn't say anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
And innocent people, you know, start to feel trapped. And they think that, you know, I've just got to get out of this. You know, it's been going on interminably. I don't know how much longer it's going to go on. I just have to get out of this situation. And so they'll tell the police what they think the police want to hear in the naive belief that later investigations will prove their innocence. But once somebody confesses, basically the police are going to stop investigating. They're not going to look for, you know, the person who really did it, because they believe that they have the guilty person. And so some of the psychologists say that, you know, being innocent actually puts a person at risk exactly because of their belief in a just world, and that eventually their innocence will come out.
Hmm.
So that, you know, lengthy interrogations, the use of lots of coercive tactics that sort of overwhelm a person and just make them feel like they have to give up. And being young, I mean, that's the other thing that shows up in the false confession research, is that police elicit a disproportionate number of false confessions from the very youngest suspects, from people, from juveniles, and especially from the younger juveniles, from those 15 and younger. Even though juveniles only commit a small fraction of the most serious kinds of crimes in which false confessions occur, murder and rape and those kinds of crimes, about a third of all false confessions were obtained from juveniles, and the majority of them were obtained from the ones 15 and younger, which go back to the point I was making earlier in our conversation that the younger kids are especially at risk in the interrogation room.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Dave on the line in Euless. Hello, Dave.
Hi. One thing that you had just mentioned and is really a particular concern to me is the idea that police officers, when interrogating anyone, an adult, and I think even as an adult, it's a unjustifiable practice, but certainly with a child, that they can actually lie to the suspects, and implying, as you said, that someone witnessed it or they have some sort of evidence to prove it. And in our society, I know that as a child, I was always taught, and I think children in general are taught, that if there's ever a problem, if you ever have to count on someone or rely on someone, you can always trust the police. And I think that's sort of implicit in being raised as a child in this society. And I know, perhaps I'm a bit naive, but I know that even as a young adult, I would say, even into my early 20s, if you had asked me, well, if a police officer is interrogating you as a suspect, can they lie to you? I genuinely would have thought that they either would not be willing to, or it would actually be illegal for them to.
Yeah, the Supreme Court has upheld police disinformation and lying and the use of false evidence ploys, and it raises lots of questions. I mean, it raises questions about integrity and the administration of the justice system, and to what extent is it okay for the government to lie to citizens? And generally, you know, if a politician lies, we think less of them. and so part of the problem is that the Supreme Court has said that it's all right in the context of interrogation to lie or to use false evidence. And part of the reason the court has upheld those kinds of strategies is, again, we have so little information about what actually happens in the interrogation room that the courts are reluctant to try to impose many kinds of restrictions because they don't know what the effect of those restrictions would be on the ability of police to elicit incriminating evidence. I mean, that was part of the concern when the Supreme Court decided Miranda, that if you tell people they have rights, they'll know they have rights and they actually exercise those rights. And so it's exactly because we don't know what happens in the interrogation room that the courts have imposed very, very few restrictions on what police can do. And that involves both the use of false evidence ploys. It involves the ability of police to keep questioning suspects for very lengthy periods of time. And again, in the false confession area, the use of false evidence shows up quite regularly. And as part of the process of contaminating a confession to make it seem more truthful when the information is really coming from the police rather than from the suspect.
Barry, talk about this. I have always assumed that if, God forbid, one of my kids gets arrested as a teenager, that I'll be notified right away. And it turns out that may be true for me, but it's not true for everybody.
The law in the vast majority of states does not require the presence of a parent at their child's interrogation. And I think Texas is one that does not require parental presence. When courts look at whether or not a juvenile has waived their rights knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily under the totality of circumstances, one of the factors they look at is whether or not a parent was present or not. But the law does not require a juvenile's parent to be present, and in the vast majority of cases, they're not present. And interestingly, police are under no obligation to even notify a parent that they've taken a kid into custody and are about to question them. You know, so that the law doesn't. And again, the police are concerned that if a parent is there, the parent is going to interfere, or it will change the dynamic in the interrogation room. And again, because courts don't know what the effect of requiring a parent's presence would be, they have typically shied away from trying to regulate interrogation of juveniles in this way.
But it turns out that race and social class and prior arrest records do play into the likelihood that a parent will be notified.
Well, one of the variables I looked at was police practices in our two urban counties and in two suburban counties. The urban counties are where Minneapolis and St. Paul are. And then I also looked at the adjoining suburban counties. And there were all sorts of interesting things going on, you know, as you contrast urban and suburban settings. Black kids disproportionately live in the urban counties and white kids disproportionately live in the suburban counties. And just because of the greater affluence in suburban counties, you know, they typically have median family incomes about $10,000 or $12,000 more than in the urban counties, the police departments in the suburban counties are a little more what some of the urban cops said are touchy-feely. And the police chiefs in those departments, as a matter of their political relationship with their constituents, were more likely to have their police notify parents that they were going to question kids. So that in the suburban counties, the police, even though the law did not require them to do so, typically would call a parent, and the parents invariably said, "Go ahead and question my kid."
Really?
Yeah, I was, you know, one of the things I was really surprised at was the extent to which parents allowed police to question their kids and allowed them to question their kids without their even being there. I mean, there were many instances in which the parents would actually bring the juvenile down to the police station, and then the officers would take the juvenile in the back room, and the parents would just sit out in the lobby rather than even accompanying their child into the interrogation room with them. So that whatever the protective role that some states' law envisions, parents in practice are not really in a position to protect their kids. They may not understand the Miranda rights any better than their kids.
Barry C. Feld is with us. He is Centennial Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota and author of Kids, Cops, and Confessions, Inside the Interrogation Room. We'll take more of your emails and calls after the break. You can get in touch with us at 1-800-933-5372 or think at kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program and Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the author of the new book, Kids, Cops, and Confessions, Inside the Interrogation Room. Barry C. Feld is Centennial Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we hear from John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hello. I have two questions. One, if the child or anyone waives their rights, can they later reassert them? And also, once one waives their rights, are the police still allowed to continue the interrogation, even though someone said, "I want an attorney"? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. The answer, those are really both the same questions, whether somebody who's waived their rights can subsequently invoke their rights. And the answer is, yes, you can. But you have to do it clearly and unambiguously and with adult-like technical precision, which is to say, and I actually had a few cases where the police had begun interrogating a juvenile and the juvenile had waived their rights, and then as the police officer started sort of drilling down a little harder, the juvenile said, "I want a lawyer." And interrogation must cease. And that's really the magic word. You know, if anybody's ever in trouble and you find yourself in the interrogation room, you have to say, "I want a lawyer." And it has to be that simple, direct, and clear. And anything that is less clear than that, police may, if it's ambiguous, or if the police think it's ambiguous, they will continue to question somebody. And your rights exist as long as you are in custody and being questioned, so that, you know, even if you've started to talk with the police, you can certainly say later, I want a lawyer.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Ed is on the line next in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Mr. Seafell. I wonder if in your comments earlier about false confessions, if the fact that you live in a state that doesn't have the death penalty might be causing you to overlook one very strong impetus for false confessions, and that is in a state like Texas, where the death penalty, a defendant that truly believes they're innocent may decide under pressure from the police, especially without a, you know, a juvenile defendant, without a parent present, without an attorney, may decide, well, I'd better confess, because if I don't confess, I may get the death penalty. At least if I confess, if they're just offering me prison, the prison is better than death.
Yeah, well, theoretically, police are not supposed to be talking to suspects about, you know, the consequences, because those start looking like threats or promises or inducements. And the Supreme Court has said in a whole host of cases that you can't threaten a suspect in order to elicit a confession. You know, it may be that somebody is thinking that in the back of their minds, well, maybe things will go easier. And one of the interrogation tactics that police use is a tactic called minimization techniques. And minimization techniques are the kinds of psychological manipulations to lessen the seriousness of the consequences, or to blame the victim, or to give some kind of justification or excuse that make it easier for somebody to confess.
So in other words, it's like saying you only pulled the trigger because you thought he was going to hurt you, right? And then you get the defendant to say, well, that's right.
That's right. That's right. And you see lots of, I mean, I had cases of drive-by shootings where, you know, the cop would say to the kid, well, you know, I mean, drive-by shooting is a serious crime, but you didn't actually hit anybody, so it's not so bad. But, you know, going back to the question about false confessions and the death penalty, you know, suspects, when they're trapped in the interrogation room, and I use trapped because they really are physically isolated, psychologically isolated, you know, they're just squirming trying to figure out, how do I get out of this situation? And, you know, the idea that, well, I'm going to try to avoid the death penalty, but will leave myself exposed to life without parole, that's not a significant difference in the way people are going to think when they're being confronted by a police officer.
So let's talk about some of the remedies to what ails the juvenile interrogation system now. One fix would be to require that all interrogations be recorded. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. You know, and if I can accomplish anything with this book and the research I'm doing now, it is that every state will require police to record all custodial interrogations of juveniles and adults, because recording is an absolute no-brainer. It gives us an objective, independent record that fosters transparency of the process and accountability. And part of what my research shows is that you can have a justice system in which everything is on the record, and police are still able to obtain Miranda waivers, they're still able to obtain confessions and admissions. You know, it doesn't have any negative impact on justice administration, and it makes it a much, much cleaner system. I was very impressed by the professionalism of the police work that I saw in all of these tapes, because the police knew that they were on the record. And out of 307 interrogations, there was only one in which a police officer disregarded a Miranda invocation. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an astounding level of compliance. The second part of the recording requirement is it really saves the criminal justice system a lot of money. You don't have to have police and prosecutors and defense lawyers and judges conducting suppression hearings on what was said in the interrogation room, because we have an objective record of what was said in the interrogation room. And as a result, there were virtually no suppression hearings, no suppression motions filed to challenge the admissibility of these statements. So, you know, recording is a reform that benefits everybody in the system. It benefits the police, it benefits the prosecution, it benefits the justice system, it benefits defense lawyers because they don't have to waste time. You know, if their client says, well, the cops did this or did that, then the defense lawyer has to move forward based on what their client says without any independent way to verify what actually happened. So it's really the no-brainer of criminal justice law reform.
What are the practical implications of, say, requiring that all juveniles below a certain age be given automatic access to legal counsel before they're questioned?
Yeah, when we started this conversation, I was making the point that the juveniles who are 15 and younger are really psychologically and developmentally on a very different footing than those who are 16 and older. They have a much, much more limited understanding of the words of the Miranda warning, of the rights that the warning conveys, and it really doesn't make much sense to give a warning to somebody in a language they don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And for many of the younger juveniles, the warning just doesn't have any practical utility at all. And as I mentioned earlier, we see a disproportionate number of false confessions also elicited from these younger juveniles. So that my research suggests that the older kids do have a fair understanding, and to the extent that my research corroborates that part of the developmental psychology, it also suggests that the developmental psychologists are correct, that these younger kids really are pretty impaired in terms of their ability to cope with the justice system. And to that extent, they really do need the assistance of counsel. And, you know, most of the professional policy groups, the American Bar Association, the Juvenile Justice Standards Project, you know, most of the professional policy groups have said that these younger kids are so vulnerable to false confessions and at such a disadvantage in the justice system that they really do need heightened protections just to put them on an even footing with older adolescents, much less with adults.
Back to the phones now. This time we have David on the line in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hi. Yes, I believe I've read and heard where in some states it is illegal for a private citizen to videotape or record a police arrest or activity in a public format, like a Rodney King type situation. Is that true?
There have been some jurisdictions that have tried to restrict citizens' ability to record those kinds of police encounters. Those really don't go to the sorts of issues I'm talking about here with regard to interrogation practices, because the courts have held that, you know, when you're in an interrogation room, you do not have an expectation of privacy, and so it's perfectly okay for the police to record those kinds of encounters. You're really describing what's sort of a Fourth Amendment problem, not a Fifth Amendment problem.
Can you talk a little bit about how other countries handle the questioning of juvenile suspects and how that might differ from the system in the U.S.?
Well, in many of the
we'll say democratic countries, if that
yeah,
helps
oh yeah, yeah. I mean, the recording requirement that Minnesota has and that Wisconsin and Alaska have is similar to what the law is in Great Britain, in New Zealand, in Australia, in Norway. You know, all of those countries also have recording requirements, and much of the available research outside of the U.S. Has been done in the United Kingdom, because they've been taping interrogations since the mid-90s as well. So that again, the first requirement is just having a recording. In Great Britain, they also have a requirement that for the questioning of juveniles, there has to be an appropriate adult present. And in some of the Scandinavian countries, they require the presence of somebody from the social welfare department to be present.
Mm-hmm.
The research in Great Britain with appropriate adults is similar to what I saw in the interrogations I had in which parents were present. And that is, parents are not a very effective safeguard. In the interrogations in which there were actually parents present, you know, and those were mostly the suburban counties we were talking about earlier, the police had developed a couple of strategies to neutralize parents.
Hmm.
You know, one was to say, well, you know, in order to be an effective parent, you have to know the truth. And you want to be an effective parent, right? So don't you want to help us get the truth? So they would either enlist the parent as an ally during the interrogation, or they would reduce the ability of the parent to participate by having them sit back in the corner behind the kid and warn them that don't interrupt our interrogation. And so what I saw was that in all but two of the interrogations in which parents were present, parents either played no role or they actively joined with the police, urging their children to tell the police the truth. Because, you know, every parent raises their kid to tell the truth. And so the parental advice with which we socialize our children is not going to be good legal advice when they're facing felony charges. And similarly, the research in the United Kingdom also suggests that appropriate adults do not provide much by way of a safeguard for juveniles when they're being questioned in the UK. So, you know, if you want to protect somebody in the interrogation room, they really need a lawyer. A parent, you know, unless the parent is a lawyer, and even then they may have a conflict of interest, is not going to be able to provide their kid with the assistance they need.
Is it reasonable, Barry, for people to worry that enacting some of the reforms that we've talked about in the past few minutes would allow more guilty juveniles to go unpunished?
Well, a recording requirement certainly would not. A recording requirement would, if anything, make it easier to establish the suspect's guilt.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that's a reform that is at worst neutral and at best a benefit to the state in terms of the ability to convict the guilty and exclude the innocent from further processing. A requirement that lawyers be present would certainly have some limiting effect on police ability to question suspects. But as I said, my policy recommendation really only extends to the very young juveniles. And fortunately, the very young juveniles do not account for a significant part of the serious crime problem, so that it would have at most a limited impact on the overall administration of justice. And again, part of the justice system is to be a fundamentally fair process and to take advantage of ignorance and vulnerability is not a fair justice.
Got to jump in here. We're out of time. Barry C. Feld's new book is Kids, Cops, and Confessions Inside the Interrogation Room. Barry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can find out more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.